Greetings. We begin the 10th chapter in Essays on the Gita, the Yoga of the Intelligent Will. And I might share something personal with you. The first time I ever had the entirety of the essays in my lap was, I think, in the fall of 1971. And the first chapter that I got to read was The Yoga of the Intelligent Will. I had been very struck by the small book that Anil Baran Roy had put together, which was titled Message of the Gita, drawn from Sri Aurobindo's essays, in which a number of the shlokas were rendered and the rest translated to make a complete 18-chapter version. And the passages that Sri Aurobindo had written in essays were astonishing. But this was the first chapter I ever had the opportunity to read from beginning to end. Now, until then, I had considered myself to be an advocate, an ardent seeker, styled after Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda. But this simple chapter, and philosophic as it is, by the time I finished reading it, I felt that I had read truth as well as could be put into words. And from that moment, I continued to have great respect and reverence for all other teachers, but I knew that Sri Aurobindo was for me. So this chapter saw print on the 15th of May in 1917. It was preceded, of course, by The Life Divine. And in that issue, the title was Knowledge in Immortality. And the synthesis of yoga essay was titled The Soul and Its Liberation. So we can see we're very much ensconced in the same material here in Essays on the Gita. Now he's going to speak to us about having had to talk to us about the abstruse matters of Sankhya philosophy. We're not done with it. We immediately have to look at the world as it's constructed by nature, and what is our relationship in terms of our consciousness and the power of will with nature. In other words, how does Purusha interact with Prakriti? So we're right back there, and we'll always be dealing with Sankhya Yoga. Some of it is Sankhya and some of it is yoga. Shall we see which is which and what is what? So chapter 10, The Yoga of the Intelligent Will. I have had to deviate in the last two essays and to drag the reader with me into the arid tracts of metaphysical dogma. However, cursorily and with a very insufficient and superficial treatment, so that we might understand why the Gita follows the peculiar line of development it has taken, working out first a partial truth with only subdued hints of its deeper meaning, then returning upon its hints and bringing out their significance until it rises to its last great suggestion, its supreme mystery, which it does not work out at all, but leaves to be lived out, as the later ages of Indian spirituality tried to live it out in great waves of love, of surrender, of ecstasy. Its eye is always on its synthesis, and all its strains are the gradual preparation of the mind for its high closing note. I have declared to you the poise of a self-liberating intelligence in Sankhya, says the divine teacher to Arjuna. Chapter 2, Shlokas 39 and 40. And we'll return to it, that pair of shlokas, a lot. I will now declare to you another poise in yoga. You are shrinking from the results of your works. You desire other results and turn from your right path in life because it does not lead you to them. But this idea of works and their result, desire of result as the motive, the work as a means for the satisfaction of desire, is the bondage of the ignorant who know not what works are, nor their true source, nor their real operation, nor their high utility. My yoga will free you from all bondage of the soul to its works. Karma bandham prahasyasi. 2:39. You are afraid of many things, afraid of sin, afraid of suffering, afraid of hell and punishment, afraid of God, afraid of this world, afraid of the hereafter, afraid of yourself. What is it that you are not afraid of at this moment? You, the Aryan fighter, the world's chief hero. But this is the great fear which besieges humanity. Its fear of sin and suffering now and hereafter. Its fear in a world of whose true nature it is ignorant. Of a God whose true being also it has not seen, and whose cosmic purpose it does not understand. My yoga will deliver you from the great fear, and even a little of it will bring deliverance. Again, 2:40. When you have once set out on this path, you will find that no step is lost. Every least movement will be a gain. You will find there no obstacle that can balk you of your advance. See chapter 6, shlokas 37 and 8. A bold and absolute promise, and one to which the fearful and hesitating mind, beset and stumbling in all its paths, cannot easily lend an assured trust. Nor is the large and full truth of it apparent, unless with these first words of the message of the Gita, read it also the last. Abandon all laws of conduct and take refuge in me alone. I will deliver you from all sin and evil. Do not grieve. Chapter 18, Shloka 66. But it is not with this deep and moving word of God to man, but rather with the first necessary rays of light on the path, directed not like that to the soul, but to the intellect, that the exposition begins. Not the friend and lover of man speaks first, but the guide and teacher who has to remove from him his ignorance of his true self and of the nature of the world and of the springs of his own action. Have a look at chapter 3, shloka 9. So, ignorance of self, ignorance of cosmos, ignorance of one's own motivation. For it is because he acts ignorantly, with a wrong intelligence, and therefore a wrong will in these matters, that man is or seems to be bound by his works. Again, 239. Otherwise, works are no bondage to the free soul. It is because of this wrong intelligence that he has hope and fear, wrath and grief and transient joy. Otherwise, works are possible with a perfect serenity and freedom. Therefore, it is the yoga of the buddhi, the intelligence, that is first enjoined on Arjuna. To act with right intelligence, and therefore a right will, fixed in the One, aware of the oneself in all, and acting out of its equal serenity, not running about in different directions under the thousand impulses of our superficial mental self, is the yoga of the intelligent will. Buddhi Yoga. So Sri Aurobindo has agreed tacitly with the commentary offered by Sri Ramanuja on the Gita, Gita Bhashya, in asserting that knowledge gives freedom, Sankhya gives knowledge, but yoga gives a still greater freedom. It is after gaining knowledge, after gaining insight, that one must continue to work, to act, so that works become correct, become inspired, and become an effective display of the divine will in life. Sri Aurobindo's words above about the great message of the Gita at the end and how all of Indian development along this line towards bhakti yoga speaks to this, finds its first utterance from Ramanuja. His philosophy, Vishishtadvaita Vedanta, the school which is often called qualified non-dualism, that's not the way to describe it. Sri Aurobindo wouldn't like that. What if we regarded it as differenced unity, oneness of being, which can remain entirely itself, undisturbed, and yet be expressed, be manifest in variegated forms? There are, says the Gita, two types of intelligence in the human being. The first is concentrated, poised, one, homogeneous, directed singly towards the truth. Unity is its characteristic. Concentrated fixity is its very being. In the other, there is no single will, no unified intelligence, but only an endless number of ideas, many branching, coursing about, that is to say, in this or that direction, in pursuit of the desires which are offered to it by life and by the environment. Buddhi, the word used, means, properly speaking, the mental power of understanding. But it is evidently used by the Gita in a large philosophic sense for the whole action of the discriminating and deciding mind, which determines both the direction and use of our thoughts and the direction and use of our acts. Thought, intelligence, judgment, perceptive choice and aim are all included in its functioning. For the characteristic of the unified intelligence is not only concentration of the mind that knows, but especially concentration of the mind that decides and persists in the decision. Vyavasaya. Vyavasaya, pardon me. And that's chapter 2, shloka 41. While the sign of the dissipated intelligence is not so much even discursiveness of the ideas and perceptions as discursiveness of the aims and desires, therefore of the will. Will, then, and knowledge are the two functions of the buddhi. We see here the Gita's use of a term which may be fixed in nomenclature about 1,000 years later, when the Sankhya Karikas are ordinated. But here in the Gita, Sankhya is not so fixed. We don't find those same connotations in the way the Gita uses the language and the terminology. Note also here the idea of will and knowledge being paired in a central organizing intelligence. This is reflective of how he interprets chit or chit tapas. If we can say anything about the nature of true being, we can say not only that it is, but that it is self-aware, and that its nature of self-experience is unwalled delight. So it is sat-chit-ananda. So at the basis of organizing the nature of being and consciousness, will and knowledge are paired at the high level. The unified, intelligent will is fixed in the enlightened soul. It is concentrated in inner self-knowledge. The many branching and multifarious, busied with many things, careless of the one thing needful, is on the contrary subject to the restless and discursive action of the mind, dispersed in outward life and works and their fruits. Works are far inferior, says the teacher, to yoga of the intelligence. Desire, rather, refuge in the intelligence. Poor and wretched souls are they who make the fruit of their works the object of their thoughts and activities. Shloka 49 in chapter 2. Again, referring to illuminated work. So, don't get lost. This is going to get flipped shortly. We must remember the psychological order of the Sankhya, which the Gita accepts. On one side, there is the Purusha, the soul, calm, inactive, immutable, one, not evolutive. On the other side, there is prakriti, or nature force, inert, without the conscious soul, active, but only by juxtaposition to that consciousness, by contact with it, as we would say, not so much one at first as indeterminate, triple in its qualities, capable of evolution and involution. The contact of soul and nature generates the play of subjectivity and objectivity, which is our experience of being. What is to us the subjective first evolves, because the soul consciousness is the first cause. In conscient nature force, only the second and dependent cause. But still, it is nature and not soul, which supplies the instruments of our subjectivity. So, if we are looking at this in terms of a cosmic hierarchy, this is again a replication of the Sankhyan scheme. At the top of Prakriti's worlds, stands the power and the function of buddhi, the intelligent will. And the subjective aspect of buddhi stands first. First the inner truth, then the outer. So it moves from the subjective to the objective and begins to create the instruments of that subjectivity. All flows out of buddhi, but buddhi pursuing the action of the creation of these instruments becomes increasingly identified with them. Let's move on. First in order come buddhi, discriminative or determinative power evolving out of nature force, and its subordinate power of self-discriminating ego. So out of this consciousness, there is this faculty that says, I am. This is the ahamkara, the I-maker. Aham, I, kara, creation, maker, work. So buddhi sets forth an ego to speak for itself. Then, as a secondary evolution, there arises out of these the power which seizes the discriminations of objects, sense mind, or manas. We must record the Indian names because the corresponding English words are not real equivalents, but the corresponding English word would be mind. And we think of mind as a penetrating intelligence that figures things out. Here, manas has a different organizing function. The higher consciousness, buddhi, is not equivalent to the mind. Watch the rest of this. As a tertiary, and tertiary is a word that means third, as a tertiary evolution out of sense mind, we have the specializing organic senses, 10 in number, 5 of perception, sound, form, scent, etc., which give their value to objects for the mind and make things what they are to our subjectivity, and as the substantial basis of these, the primary conditions of the objects of sense, the 5 elements of ancient philosophy, or rather, elementary conditions of nature, pancha bhuta, which constitute objects by their various combination. So we see, cascading down from buddhi, the sense of the eye maker. And then, from ahankara, there is the organization of manas and the creation of subtle perception and then objects which perception can grasp at. So again, from the subtle to the obvious, from the subjective to the objective, all the way down. The supreme subjectivity is above. Yeah, that's buddhi, the first element of prakriti. But all the rest flows from that. Reflected in the pure consciousness of Purusha, reflected in the pure consciousness of Purusha, these degrees and powers of nature force become the material of our impure subjectivity. Impure because its action is dependent on the perceptions of the objective world and on their subjective reactions. So the pure consciousness of the Purusha is not involved in the play of nature, not even involved, really, in the play of buddhi. Simply, it's like the moon reflected in the waters of a lake. But all the rest is the play of nature, reflected in the sight of Purusha. Buddhi, which is simply the determinative power that determines all inertly out of indeterminate inconscient force, takes for us the form of intelligence and will. It seems to be conscious, it seems to be intelligent. Well, it is, but only by derivation from the light reflected on it by Purusha. Manas, the inconscient force which seizes nature's discriminations by objective action and reaction, and grasps at them by attraction, becomes sense perception and desire. The two crude terms or degradations of intelligence and will, becomes the sense mind, sensational, emotive, volitional, in the lower sense of wish, hope, longing, passion, vital impulsion, all the deformations, vikara, of will. The senses become all instruments of sense mind, the perceptive five of our sense knowledge, the active five of our impulsions and vital habits, mediators between the subjective and objective. The rest are the objects of our consciousness, vishayas of the senses. So along the way, we've touched upon vikara, chapter 13, shloka 19, vishayas, 245 and 262. So again, we see the cascading down of the powers of nature, each level becoming more and more objective and farther away from their conscious origin. And all of it in nature is fundamentally insentient. The only consciousness that is belongs to Purusha. All else is borrowed, and it's only the interaction of Purusha and Prakriti that permits Prakriti the liberty of the fictional play of cosmic and personal manifestation. This order of evolution seems contrary to that which we perceive as the order of the material evolution, because we think it starts below and rises up, and Sankhya is telling us it starts above and comes down. Ah, later the Ashwata tree. The origins of the cosmos, the roots of the cosmos are above and the branches extend below. So too with Prakriti. I'll start again. This order of evolution seems contrary to that which we perceive as the order of the material evolution. But if we remember that even buddhi is in itself an inert action of inconscient nature, and that there is certainly in this sense an inconscient will and intelligence, a discriminative and determinative force even in the atom, if we observe the crude inconscient stuff of sensation, emotion, memory, impulsion in the plant, and in the subconscious forms of existence, if we look at these powers of nature force assuming the forms of our subjectivity in the evolving consciousness of animal and man, we shall see that the Sankhya system squares well enough with all that modern inquiry has elicited by its observation of material nature. This is John Locke 1,000 years earlier. Well, 1,500 years earlier. In the evolution of the soul back from Prakriti towards Purusha, the reverse order has to be taken to the original nature evolution. And that is how the Upanishads and the Gita following and almost quoting the Upanishads state the ascending order of our subjective powers. Supreme, they say, beyond their objects are the senses. Supreme over the senses, the mind. Supreme over the mind, the intelligent will. That which is supreme over the intelligent will is he, is the conscious self, the Purusha. So this is Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, shloka 42, but this is also the Katha Upanishad. Very much resonant. Therefore, says the Gita, it is this Purusha, this supreme cause of our subjective life, which we have to understand and become aware of by the intelligence. In that, we have to fix our will. So holding our lower subjective self and nature firmly poised and stilled by means of the greater, really conscient self, we can destroy the restless, ever-active enemy of our peace and self-mastery, the mind's desire. For evidently, there are two possibilities of the action of the intelligent will. It may take its downward and outward orientation towards a discursive action of the perceptions and the will in the triple play of Prakriti, or it may take its upward and inward orientation towards a settled peace and equality in the calm and immutable purity of the conscious, silent soul, no longer subject to the distractions of nature. In the former alternative, the subjective being is at the mercy of the objects of sense. It lives in the outward contact of things. That life is the life of desire. For the senses, excited by their objects, create a restless or often violent disturbance, a strong or even headlong outward movement towards the seizure of these objects and their enjoyment, and they carry away the sense mind as the winds carry away a ship upon the sea. The mind, subjected to the emotions, passions, longings, impulsions, awakened by this outward movement of the senses, carries away similarly the intelligent will, which loses, therefore, its power of calm discrimination and mastery. So along the way, we see that this immersion in the downward movement of nature is our problem. So look to chapter 2, shloka 60, and then later on this section about the winds carrying away the ship, 267. So Krishna is fixing upon the problem that it is desire which is singularly at issue here. It is the conquest of desire to which we will move quickly. It is the problem of desire and what Arjuna thinks he wants, which has confused him and led him away from his sense of duty, his sense of self, his place in the cosmos. So this business about desire has to be taken seriously. To gratify oneself is not the object and the purpose of life. To know oneself is necessary for any abiding satisfaction to exist. If you want felicity, it only flows from the soul, from oneness of being. Being who you really are. Again, sat-chit-ananda. You have delight when you really know yourself. Subjection of the soul to the confused play of the three gunas of Prakriti and their eternal entangled twining and wrestling, ignorance, a false, sensuous, objective life of the soul, enslavement to grief and wrath and attachment and passion are the results of the downward trend of the buddhi, the troubled life of the ordinary, unenlightened, undisciplined man. Those who, like the Vedavadins, make sense enjoyment the object of action and its fulfillment the highest aim of the soul are misleading guides. The inner subjective self-delight independent of objects, is our true aim and the high and wide poise of our peace and liberation. Again, 242 and 243. The Vedavadins, those who follow the external sense of the Veda, perform the ritual, do the deed, you get the result, you have heaven on earth. Not so simple. We'll do one more paragraph. Therefore, it is the upward and inward orientation of the intelligent will that we must resolutely choose with a settled concentration and perseverance, vyavasaya, which means one-pointed, and that's chapter 2, shloka 41. We must fix it firmly in the calm self-knowledge of the Purusha. Fix what? The buddhi, our awakening power of intuition, which is not sheer awareness, but has within it a cognate force. It is intelligent will. The first movement must be obviously to get rid of desire, which is the whole root of the evil and suffering. And in order to get rid of desire, we must put an end to the cause of desire, the rushing out of the senses to seize and enjoy their objects. We must draw them back when they are inclined thus to rush out, draw them away from their objects, as the tortoise draws in his limbs into the shell, so these into their source, quiescent in the mind quiescent in intelligence, the intelligence quiescent in the soul and its self-knowledge, observing the action of nature, but not subject to it, not desiring anything that the objective life can give. 258, the tortoise or the tortoise, how is it pronounced? Kurmaha in Sanskrit. So look at this. This is beautiful. This is the very image of the stages of meditation. The first thing that we do is sit and still the body. Well, we bring it into equipoise. We don't let it become restless. We hold it steady. Then we make steady the breath. Pacify, regularize the life energy in us. And then we begin to take our senses away from what calls from outside. The senses become inwardly placed, calm. Then we take our conscious attention away from the senses altogether, retire into that which uses the senses. In other words, the manas. Stilling the manas, we proceed more deeply into the buddhi and there achieve quietude. But not entirely do we have quietude and peace until all this ceases, becomes calm and clear, and we recall what we are, the Purusha, watching all of this. Now, having attained the consciousness of the Purusha, is that all? Do we simply regard or not regard nature? What is liberation? And the Gita will challenge us to resume, to bring knowledge attained back into life and a different order of being arises. We'll look at the rest of the chapter next time. Thank you for, I think, a long evening. Thank you for your patience. If you don't mind, I think I'll close with a section from Savitri, Book 2. The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Little Life. And let's go to the bottom of page 146. A difficult evolution from below, called a masked intervention from above. Else this great, blind, inconscient universe could never have disclosed its hidden mind, or even in blinkers worked in beast and man, the intelligence that devised the cosmic scheme. At first he saw a dim, obscure mind power, moving, concealed by matter and dumb life. A current thin, it streamed in life's vast flow, tossing and drifting under a drifting sky, amid the surge and glimmering tremulous wash, released in splash of sense and feelings waves. In the deep midst of an insentient world, its huddled waves and foam of consciousness ran, pressing and eddying through a narrow strait, carrying experience in its crowded pace. It flowed, emerging into upper light, from the deep pool of its subliminal birth to reach some high existence still unknown. There was no thinking self. Aim, there was none. All was unorganized stress and seekings vague. Only to the unstable surface rose sensations, stabs, and edges of desire, and passion's leaps, and brief emotion's cries. A casual colloquy of flesh with flesh, a murmur of heart to longing wordless heart, glimmerings of knowledge with no shape of thought, and jets of subconscious will or hunger's pulls. All was dim sparkle on a foaming top. It whirled around a drifting shadow self on an inconscient flood of force and time. Then came the pressure of a seeing power that drew all into a dancing turbid mass, circling around a single luminous point, center of reference in a conscious field, figure of a unitary light within. It lit the impulse of the half-sentient flood, even an illusion gave of fixity, as if a sea could serve as a firm soil. That strange observing power imposed its sight. It forced on flux a limit and a shape. It gave its stream a lower, narrow bank, drew lines to snare the spirit's formlessness. It fashioned the life-mind of bird and beast, the answer of the reptile and the fish, the primitive pattern of the thoughts of man. A finite movement of the infinite came winging its way through a wide air of time. A march of knowledge moved in nescience and guarded in the form a separate soul. Its right to be immortal it reserved, but built a wall against the siege of death and threw a hook to clutch eternity. Well, namaste.